This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Carrie Leiterson, a reporter for The Washington Post, who's the author of Out of the Sea and Into the Fire, Latin American U.S. Immigration in the Global Age. Carrie Leiterson, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
You cover events in this book from Bolivia and Ecuador and Honduras and Mexico, the U.S. border, other spots in the United States, but the first half focuses on Latin America. What got you interested in Latin America? How long have you been covering that?
I've probably been covering Latin America for about 6 or 7 years, and it really just came about living in Chicago, doing that. I was reporting on other local housing issues, things in the schools, and some environmental justice stories and things like that. And it just turned out, you know, like in any major city or any small town, actually, for that matter, that there are so many Latin American immigrants in Chicago that it was turning out that a lot of my friends or people I was interviewing on things unrelated to immigration were immigrants and had these incredible stories of how they came here, the reasons they came here, what kinds of work or organizing they were doing, that it just sort of was a natural development.
And you took yourself to parts of Latin America. Was that on assignment for the Washington Post, or were you freelancing?
No.
What were you doing there?
I work in the Midwest Bureau of the Post, so it wasn't. It was unrelated to that. But, my first couple trips were with groups like Pastors for Peace and the Mexico Solidarity Network that were really great in setting up, making the connections that are hard to make if you just show up out of the blue. And then once I got more experienced, I did a little more traveling on my own. But, those sort of solidarity / reporting trips, I think, are really great things.
You do your own photography, too, I see in here.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big interest of yours?
Oh, yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Photos are great. The theme of the book, why don't you explain what it is? Because you talk about, I think, one spot early in the book, you say that the role of globalization exceeds even that of the conquistadors in Latin America, which is quite a statement.
Yeah, and I probably meant that a little bit more artistically. I'm not set to do an academic proof of that statement, but I feel like, you know, I don't like to be too black and white about globalization, and I don't like it when people make big sweeping statements about globalization without really thinking it through, because I mean it's a complex thing, obviously, and I think there's some benefits to globalization at the internet and just the increases in communication between people in different countries, and the whole globalization of resistance, I think, is amazing. But what I was trying to get at with that is basically the effects of neoliberal economic policies and foreign investment and development in Latin America. It just really seems overwhelming. I mean, the effects seem to touch so many people, just about everybody there, and with such really devastating consequences in so many cases that I think it is hard to overstate the effect, because I think it's just really touching everybody in that region these days.
Well, can you give an example for people who are not that familiar with neoliberal globalization, how it adversely affects peasants, for instance, either in Mexico or in Bolivia?
Yeah. The kind of textbook one that people always refer to is with corn in Mexico, how virtual obliteration of tariffs with NAFTA and even before NAFTA made it so cheap for the U.S. to import corn. And of course, corn here is subsidized. So that's a whole nother thing. But it became so cheap for corn, say, grown in Iowa to be sold in southern Mexico, that farmers growing corn without automation and rugged hillsides and, you know, without the cost efficiency that U.S. farmers have, really couldn't compete. So the already subsistence level existence that they were earning selling their corn was kind of wiped out because it wouldn't even be profitable, say, for them to make the day long trek to bring their corn to market when corn grown, you know, 2,000 miles away.
So what happens to them?
Well, in that case, if the farmers can't make a living growing their crops anymore, a lot of times they migrate to a city would be the first step, like to the local, you know, if it's Oaxaca City or the local big city, and then maybe to Mexico City. And if they still can't make a living there, to the border. And this is really oversimplified, obviously, but it is a pretty common trend. And then a lot of people, of course, cross the border into the U.S. and try to make it here. And, you know, ironically, a lot of times work in agriculture, doing a similar thing to what they were doing before, but for a big company or landowner as opposed to for a family subsistence operation. And then that's one simple way to describe it. But then there's also the whole, depending on the country and the region, the political repression that goes around with, you know, say places where there's oil exploration or drilling, or these big African palm plantations or eucalyptus plantations or other large scale, you know, multinational enterprises. Usually along with that, there's battles over lands with the local people, and that, depending on the place, might lead to paramilitary activity or, say with the Zapatistas, low intensity warfare or all different factors related to globalization that displace people or make it unsafe for people to keep doing the things they were doing.
As far as the corporations go, Kerry Leiterson, I think you mentioned two in specific that I remember anyway. One is Coke in Honduras, Coca-Cola Company.
Yeah.
And you also cite the amazing consumption statistics of Coca-Cola in Latin America. And I think the other one was so it was Coke, Colombia, Dole, and Honduras.
Yeah. The Coke in Colombia, this isn't directly, I'll come back to Coke in just a second, but one real current thing in the news that shows, you know, just another example of what the conditions are like in Colombia. Just the other day, a Colombian activist was scheduled to go to Chicago for a conference, and he was denied a visa by the U.S. and then on his way home was kidnapped by paramilitaries and is still missing as of now. His community had been fighting an African palm plantation in this ongoing land struggle. So anyway, there's kidnappings and murders of union activists or community land rights activists in Colombia just on a constant drumbeat basis. And the story I was covering in Colombia, and that's the one country which I didn't actually visit. I really want to go there, but that story I reported from Chicago. There'd been a score of murders of union members in the Coca-Cola bottling plants there. And the man I focused on has gotten political asylum in the U.S. He lives in Chicago now, and he just narrowly escaped with his life. He was actually kidnapped and then managed to get away and to eventually end up in the U.S. But the one of the kind of tricky things there, which is pretty common in a lot of corporate situations in Latin America, is that it's the Coke bottling plants that are the issue. So the bottling plants are run by, they're actually separate companies, which are contractors with Coke.
So this gives Coca-Cola in Atlanta a little buffer.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But there has been, people have probably seen the Stop Killer Coke campaign. There's been a lot of pressure put on Coke. And it's actually sort of we'll talk about this later, but sort of a parallel to the situation with Taco Bell and the Immokalee workers.
Well, why don't you talk about that?
Okay. One of the chapters in the U.S. is about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in southern Florida. And they're a group of farm workers. There's a lot of Mexicans, but there's also a lot of Central Americans who tend to be even more vulnerable than Mexican workers. And a lot of them don't speak English. A lot of Haitians there, along with Hondurans and Guatemalans. So this was a group of workers that, like in a lot of places, especially in the South, were living and working in virtual slavery, debt slavery, and actually in some cases, literally in slavery, held under armed guard by contractors without pay and being forced to work. And the FBI actually, before and during and after the formation of the coalition, the FBI has actually, with help from the workers, busted up a few of these human slavery rings, and this issue has gotten more attention. But the Coalition of Mockley Workers was a real grassroots group that formed, and they came up with this pretty innovative strategy that I think other organizations are using now, where they decided, they picked tomatoes among other things, and they decided to choose tomatoes specifically bought by Taco Bell as kind of their wedge to open up the workers' rights issue. And their thinking was that the contractors who they work for are kind of fly by night. A lot of them are actually immigrants themselves, and they're hard to put pressure on because they have no public image, or they might not even be using their legal name or have an official legal company. But Taco Bell is obviously a huge corporation that everyone knows. So they did an intense kind of public relations campaign involving students and faith groups and workers to say that Taco Bell needed to step up to the bat and take responsibility for making sure its contractors were treating the workers right. And this was really drawn out, this campaign. They had a boycott Taco Bell campaign and different speak outs. People would get up on tables in Taco Bells around the country and start making speeches or dressing up as chihuahuas and handing out flyers. And they were pretty creative campaign. And that went on for, I think, 3 years until this spring, when they had a real victory, and Taco Bell, who had refused to meet with them for the first couple of years of the campaign, agreed to virtually all of their requests and signed this worker code of conduct and agreed to a 1 cent a bushel increase in price for tomatoes picked, which doesn't sound like much, but actually does add up to a lot for the workers. So
you're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Carrie Leiterson, who's author of the book Out of the Sea and Into the Fire, Latin American U.S. Immigration in the Global Age. When you finished the book, your chapter on Taco Bell hadn't come to this conclusion yet, mm-hmm. So the success came a little bit after. But the resistance is such a theme in this book. Resistance, you called, you talked about globalization of resistance a while ago. This is hemispheric resistance. You got resistance from Bolivia all the way up to the United States. And we are seeing, in Latin American countries, one after another, this rebellion, insurrection against neoliberalism. Did that take you by surprise, or were you expecting that?
I mean, when I started writing and learning about these things, you know, there had already been a lot of resistance. So the fact that there was all this resistance wasn't a surprise. But what was one really cool aspect of writing the book was when I set out to do it, I had this idea that it wasn't going to be a book about activism or resistance. You know, I wanted to have it be very objective, which, I mean, I certainly hope it is. But I wanted to be more reporting stories of the conditions than the activism, because I felt like, you know, that a lot of people have already written about activism, resistance, etc. So the thing was, once I started reporting the stories, it became obvious that it was always so, the resistance was always so intrinsic to the problem, that it was impossible to write a book like this and not have a big part of it be about this resistance. Because no matter how tragic and David versus Goliath, you know, any given situation was, the resistance was always very present and in a lot of cases, very effective.
What do you make of the depiction of the resistance to neoliberalism in Latin America in the mainstream press of the United States, like Tom Friedman, the New York Times? Seems to me he construes people who are resisting as know-nothings or fools or Luddites. And what's wrong with that interpretation?
Yeah, well, I think, there's two different, you know, there's the depictions of the big anti-globalization, the protests in Seattle and everywhere else. So I think that's one thing. And then also the depictions of the massive uprisings in Latin America, and the depictions of the anti-globalization, which I think is more what you're talking about, of the protests. On one hand, I think that's patronizing, because I think people obviously do have a lot of facts and a lot of information on their side. And, say with, you know, with TV, it's hard to, or it's easy to cover those protests in the wrong way because, you know, it's hard to discuss such a complex issue in a soundbite. And they usually manage to find people, who, you know, young college students or who maybe don't know what they're talking about or, so yeah, I think the coverage, of the protests is a bit patronizing and doesn't give, activists the room to discuss what knowledge and analysis they do have. And then as far as coverage of the actual uprisings, like say in Bolivia or Ecuador or, you know, in Mexico City, in support of Manuel Lopez Obrador this summer.
You know, it'll be, oh my God, he's a populist. Is it? You know, that's the worst thing you can say about someone.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big problems there is just the relative lack of coverage. You know, the if there was just more coverage, period, I'm sure a lot of it would be better. And, you know, we're also just in such different realities. I mean, even the reality of, you know, the suburban average newspaper reader in the U.S. versus, you know, the poor in New Orleans is such a huge gap that that difference in realities came out a little bit with Katrina. And then talking about peasants, indigenous peasants, you know, in the mountains in Honduras is just such a different reality that I think the media doesn't always do a good job of being able to put them to understand those situations and to write about things from a point of view other than, you know, our mainstream American reader.
How do you get to people though? I mean, how do you reach people when that experience is so distant? I mean, Katrina, the experience of poor black people in New Orleans seemed, you know, a ton of people were saying, well, it looks like a foreign country to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right here in the United States. And then you are telling stories about a foreign country, and yet you're able to make it immediate. You're able to describe in very clear terms what neoliberalism or what corporate globalization means when the economy gets dollarized in Ecuador, for instance, or the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank insists that you can't raise the minimum wage, even though everything else is becoming more expensive there, and they're laying people off in the public sector. So that's real clear. I'm just wondering how we make how the mainstream media should do that job better.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing, and I hate to keep using this cliche, but the sort of human face, you know, on one hand, you can find a human face for any story. So that in itself doesn't always make a good story. But, I think, and there has been some good reporting in the mainstream media about people crossing the border. You know, recently that's been in the news so much. And I think there has been a lot of good coverage of individual people, individual families, families of people that have died crossing the border. So I think if that quality of coverage was extended further south, to, you know, more of the regions of conflict or just to describe the, economic situations in the countries where immigrants are coming from. I mean, I think that would be a big improvement. I'm sure, you know, part of the problem as far as media goes is just lack of staff and budget.
And cutting back, yeah,
right.
On resources. You write about the border, Carrie Leiterson, and you talk about problems, including the one you just mentioned, which is, people trying to cross the border and dying of heat exhaustion. And I think in this summer past, in 2005, a record number of people died crossing the border into California and Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
What was your experience reporting on that?
That was really interesting. I was down there, I guess, a year before the whole Minutemen thing became so big. And I was with one of these groups, Civil Homeland Defense, who the leader of that, Chris Simcox, has been one of the big Minutemen people.
Is this the newspaper editor?
Yeah. Well, he bought the newspaper.
When the Tombstone
paper. Tombstone, yeah. Yeah. That was really interesting. And my main impression of them was sort of similar to this is maybe a little more extreme, but when I went to an anti KKK rally once, I felt more just kind of amused than anything, because I kind of felt like, how can people really be taking this KKK seriously? It's like 10 guys, you know. So I really wasn't impressed with the Civil Homeland Defense group. It was a small number of people, and you know, like you might expect, I mean, they just seem to be playing cowboys and Indians, and they claim to have stopped a lot of immigrants and handed them over to the Border Patrol. And I'm not sure if I even believe how many they stopped. So my experience with them was just sort of, it was just sort of amusing, and they didn't seem like a real threat to me. But I think the scary thing is that they themselves and their little games on the border, are the fringe, but a lot of the things they say are actually believed by and echoed by more of the mainstream public, you know, including union members and African Americans and people who you would hope would be more, you know, more sympathetic to immigrants.
Which is to say, they're taking your jobs.
Yeah, that's the biggest one, right? And our, you know, using our resource, our hospitals and our schools and
what's
and
wrong with
that? With those arguments. Well, for one thing, as far as the resources go, it's really not even true. I mean, immigrants don't tend to use healthcare unless they absolutely need it. And, schools, I mean, yeah, immigrants are going to schools, but, you know, of course, if they're here for a while or here to stay, that's in everybody's best interest. And it's just a ridiculous argument to say they're sucking up our resources when, you know, so much more is spent probably every 5 minutes in Iraq compared to what immigrants might be using. And then as far as the jobs goes, I mean, that's a little more complicated, because they're not taking jobs, but I mean, the presence of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. obviously has lowered the pay scale in a lot of industries. So, you know, that's a valid problem, but obviously the real question is, who do you blame? The immigrants who are here, or the whole, my immigration policy situation, where employers are able to, pay people so little and work them without benefits and everything else.
Now, the Minuteman phenomenon, has spread beyond the border. There was a Minuteman protest in Chicago on October 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Does that surprise you that it's come that far north?
I guess it doesn't surprise me, since there are so many immigrants, say, in places like Chicago, and the same, you know, the same reactionary responses people have at the border, they also have in Chicago and in small towns in the Midwest and in the South, I'm sure, and everywhere else. So in that sense, it's not surprising. But I am a little surprised there's so many, you know, you don't have that, at least I didn't think we had that, like, frontier, you know, play with guns mentality as much in Chicago as they do at the border. But I guess there's always some people that are going to be attracted to that. But yeah, one of the chapters I wrote deals with the Workers' Center in Chicago, and this has been a common thing throughout the country, where there's street corner workers' centers where people can get hired, for day labor, which is actually, relatively high paying compared to most of the other jobs immigrants do.
And there's real anti, sentiment on that, real reactionary
right.
sentiment on that. And
yeah.
what's that about?
Well, see, that's where I can kind of see where the Minutemen types draw support in a place like Chicago, because the people in these neighborhoods, they don't like, I mean, I think a lot of it is just sort of fear and discomfort. The biggest arguments they have against the workers' centers are usually things like the men harass women and they smoke pot and drink and, you know, they're out on the street. And I mean, in the U.S., we have, especially in more suburban communities, we have such a sort of expectation of neatness and orderliness that's just way beyond the pale to have, you know, these things going on that really are pretty minor and don't really pose a threat to anybody. But I think it's something different, and the combination of, you know, people of another race speaking a different language doing these things that some Americans see as really threatening is a big affront to them. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Carrie Leiterson. She's the author of a book called Out of the Sea and Into the Fire, Latin American U.S. Immigration in the Global Age. Carrie, one of the things I liked about the book was the last section where you have profiles, profiles of people who are inspirational. Mm-hmm. And one of those, Neris Gonzalez, was particularly inspirational, I thought. Can you just tell her story briefly?
Yeah, she's an amazing woman, completely amazing woman, probably one of the most inspiring people I know. She was an ecologist in El Salvador, and she became active with a church group during the Civil War. And one of her quotes, which I love so much, is she was basically teaching peasants to count because they were being screwed over by the people, the farm owners buying the produce from them. And because they couldn't count, it was really easy for them to be taken advantage of. So she said she was teaching peasants to count. And because of this, she was considered a revolutionary and therefore a target for the right-wing forces. And she was kidnapped and tortured and went through horrible things in El Salvador, and then was released finally, I think just sort of dumped in a ditch. And I mean, it was a horrible story. And she stayed there for a while after that. She had, since through her work, she had connections that she probably could have left the country right after that happened. But she was so, that experience made her even more determined to stay and work with her people. And so she continued being involved in the struggle for a while. And then eventually, still under a lot of threats, did come to the U.S. And she started working in Pilsen, which is a neighborhood that I live in.
In Chicago,
mostly Mexican neighborhood. And her way of expressing the struggle now is to help children of immigrants who might have been, you know, agrarian in their home countries, kind of reconnect with the earth. And Pilsen's one of the Chicago neighborhoods with the least trees or parks or green space. So she does these urban ecology projects, growing tilapia fish and worm composting and indoor organic vegetable gardens, and reaches tons of urban immigrant kids through these things.
There's an amazing story. Her group, I guess, is called Eco Vida or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, what do you tell people who are interested in helping out some way Latin Americans who are fighting globalization or immigrants who have come here? Do you have advice or suggestions for people?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest one is just to be aware and to understand the situation and the dynamics. And then beyond that, there's a lot of groups working with the solidarity groups working with the maquiladoras at the U.S.-Mexico border, groups like the Mexico Solidarity Network and Pastors for Peace, and a whole slew of other Central American or Latin American solidarity groups do things. I mean, I think it's really important for people to know that, you know, U.S. citizens aren't going to be the ones leading the revolution in Latin America. But we can help a lot through increasing awareness here and through just expressing our support and bringing down appropriate aid, you know, and medical supplies or things like that in the right situations.
So real people-to-people interactions.
Yeah, yeah.
On a more macro level, you ask at the end, how can progress proceed in a way that respects the human rights and dignity of all people and isn't skewed to create massive wealth for a few on the backs of the many? You have a short answer for that one.
Oh, man. Oh, wow. I think just it's one of those things, if it's going to happen, it'll be learned through the process. And, you know, people are trying a lot of interesting things in a lot of different communities and countries right now. So there's a lot of possibilities going on. We'll see what happens.
That is the fascinating thing of this moment, Carrie, isn't it? All the fermentation in Latin America in rebellion against this old model and trying new things to make the economies work more for people. Mm-hmm. It's an exciting time.
Yeah.
Carrie Leiterson, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio. Carrie Leiterson, a reporter for The Washington Post, is the author of a new book called Out of the Sea and Into the Fire, Latin American U.S. Immigration in the Global Age.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.